Capital Investment Committee will come to order April 1st. Representative Lee.
Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes for March 28th, 2019.
All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion is adopted. Oh, any opposed? Any corrections?
Nay, just to make you feel good for asking.
Thank you. The minutes are adopted as printed. House file 1216, Representative Schultz. While she's coming down, I would like to give a disclaimer that in the 90s, I was a board member of St. Mary's, which is now Essentia Health. And I was picked by the St. Mary's was a hospital that's over 100 years old, or almost 100 years old, or in that neighborhood. Anyway, it was began by the Sisters of St. Benedict at St. Scholastica, Benedictine Sisters from St. Scholastica that started this and still own property in the region that Representative Schultz is going to bring to our attention tonight. That being said, Representative Schultz, welcome to the committee. And I move House File 1216 be move adoption of 1216 and to send it on its way. But there is an amendment, Representative Schultz.
There is
A3.
I believe the A3. I recommend adoption of the A3 amendment.
I'll move the adoption of H1216A3 amendment. Questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted and 1216 is as amended is before us. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for taking time tonight to hear House File 1216. The City of Duluth, Essentia Health, and St. Luke's Hospital have been working together on the largest economic redevelopment opportunity in the city's history. Essentia Health is investing over $800 million in a new hospital and ancillary medical facilities. St. Luke's is also investing up to $200 million in new and updated facilities on their campus. These substantial private investments will change the face of the East Hillside of Duluth, providing opportunities for investment in housing and commercial ventures on land that is currently used for surface parking or occupied by old, outdated buildings. House File 1216 looks to leverage these historic private investments to obtain public infrastructure funding from the state to take advantage of this rare redevelopment opportunity. I have with me tonight officials from the City of Duluth, Essentia Health, and St. Luke's Hospital to provide more information about this exciting opportunity and to help answer questions you may have. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Phil Jentz from the City of Duluth.
Mr. Jentz, is
it? Yes. Yes.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Phil Jentz. I am the Communications and Policy Officer with the City of Duluth. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Representative Schultz's bill, House File 1216, and appreciated the committee's time tonight in giving this bill a hearing. As you have just heard from Representative Schultz, both Essentia and St. Luke's are making significant investments in their campuses in Duluth. And the public infrastructure provided in this legislation will help support the modernization of our medical institutions and will change the face of Duluth's East Hillside. This part of the city struggles with very old housing stock, a patchwork of surface parking lots, and with outdated and dilapidated infrastructure. As Essentia and St. Luke's makes these significant investments in their new medical facilities, there will be a wonderful opportunity to put previously underutilized land back into productive use. We are excited about the housing and business redevelopment opportunities this legislation will help create in a critical part of our city. We stand in support of Essentia and St. Luke's as they proceed with their exciting new construction projects, and we very much appreciate the committee's time and attention to this important development for the city of Duluth, our region, and ultimately the state of Minnesota. I would now like to turn it over to the two hospital systems to provide more information on their specific projects, I believe starting with Essentia. Thank you.
Mr. Hayward.
Good evening. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Hayward, and I am the Senior Vice President of Operations for Essentia Health. Thank you for the time this evening on your agenda, and thank you, Representative Schultz, for your leadership on this pursuit and for authoring House File 1216, which supports significant economic development in downtown Duluth, the basis of which builds upon Essentia Health's historic $800 million private investment as we modernize and consolidate our downtown campus. Thank you, Representative Murphy, for your support, and thank you again for giving us time in front of this committee. Including the materials before you, please find a one-page description of our campus modernization plan called Vision Northland, a one-page summary focusing on Essentia Health, St. Mary's Medical Center, Level 1 Trauma Designation, and a summary of my talking points this evening. Essentia Health is the largest private employer north of the Twin Cities and consists of 15 hospitals and 72 clinics across northern Minnesota, northwest Wisconsin, and northeast North Dakota. Essentia Health employs 14,500 individuals across our service area and more than 6,700 in the Twin Ports of Superior and Duluth alone. We are headquartered in Duluth with a significant presence downtown consisting of multiple clinics and two hospitals. St. Mary's Medical Center, and the former City Hospital, Miller Dwan Medical Center. Essentia Health's mission is we are called to make a healthy difference in people's lives. As we all know, medicine has and is changing rapidly. Models of care have evolved over time, and Essentia's current Duluth facility sometimes hinders our delivery of care. At the same time, patient expectations have evolved, and double occupancy rooms are no longer acceptable. Essentia's presence in Duluth, as Representative Murphy stated, dates back to 1888 when the Benedictine Sisters of St. Scholastica Monastery established St. Mary's Hospital. It has remained in its current site since 1898. Since then, it has been renovated, remodeled, and significant additions incorporated to meet the healthcare needs of residents of the Northland. Over the past several years, Essentia has undergone the process of identifying how best to meet the needs of patients we have the privilege to serve in the years ahead. Our objective is to provide the highest level of care with patient safety and satisfaction as the imperative. We also recognize the need for an environment that allows Essentia to recruit and retain industry-leading professionals and address workforce shortages. In short, we need to meet patient and employee needs that are currently fettered by our current facilities. As a result of this planning, Essentia Health has done. St. Mary's Medical Center is now the region's first and only Level 1 trauma center north of the metropolitan area. As I've stated, our Duluth campus consists of two hospitals, the 380 licensed bed St. Mary's and the 165 licensed bed Miller Dwan Medical Center, the former public hospital of Duluth. Another component of our long-term planning includes Essentia consolidating its downtown campus, which currently consists of many city blocks, to just three city blocks, and to build a new St. Mary's Medical Center bed tower, state-of-the-art ambulatory surgery center, and renovate and add clinical space in connection with St. Mary's and Miller Dwan. The $521 million investment in a new St. Mary's Medical Center, together with an additional $279 million investment in Miller Dwan Medical Center, cumulatively adds up to the significant $800 million investment in our Duluth campus. Of additional interest, as Essentia consolidates its campus, as was previously noted, there will be significant tax-exempt property returned to the tax roll for additional private development in the future. Essentia has retained McGuff Construction as our general contractor, and we estimate 80% of the project contractors and subcontractors will be Minnesota-based. I am pleased to report we have a project labor agreement in connection with this endeavor. based on data compiled through the Associated General Contractors of America and supported by an independent outside economist familiar with projects of this magnitude, the economic impact of a project this size will result in 5,680 on-site jobs during the construction phase and another 3,680 off-site but related jobs. I am here in support of House File 1216 and the benefits the proposal would have on the public infrastructure surrounding our campus and the central hillside of Duluth. Thank you again, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to share with you Essentia's significant plans and the benefits that will accrue to the patients that we are fortunate to serve. The city of Duluth, the Northland, and the state of Minnesota will also accrue significant benefits given the private investment of this scope and magnitude. I'll be available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's hear from Mr. Boschwanger before questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Mike Baselager. I'm a vice president with St. Luke's. We've included a short packet of information provided in, for your reference as well. St. Luke's was the first hospital established in Duluth. It founded in 1881. We include three hospitals serving a 17-county region spanning three states. We have two owned facilities, one in Duluth and one in Two Harbors, and a managed facility in Grand Marais. Also includes 43 primary and specialty clinics, nine urgent care and acute care locations, a level two trauma center established in 1975, regional heart and vascular center, and a regional cancer center. We have experienced tremendous growth over the years to nearly 700,000 clinic visits in 2018, increased nearly three times the number of providers employed since 2000, and we saw 13,000 inpatient admissions in 2018, and this does not include the facility in Two Harbors. In terms of employees, St. Luke's employs 2,956 employees with an average income of $92,530 per FTE. Total FTE in 2018 was 2,248, and we have consistently added 50 employees per year since 2006. As part of our campus, we have a three-phased approach to creating the medical campus of the future. And as such, we plan to invest $250 million in our region through time. Our goals are to improve patient access to facilities and services, improve patient experience, attract and retain the workforce, expand service line capacity and create growth, connect St. Luke's campus to Lake Superior and those amenities, and integrate community interests into our campus development. Beginning this month, we will conclude phase one with the completion of relocating and expanding our emergency services, cath lab, parking ramp, ambulance garage, and helistop. That consists of $37.5 million in investment. Beyond phase one is the opportunity to build a public infrastructure parking ramp, which provides economic development and opportunity, as well as providing positive social impact. There's an opportunity to create retail space on the first level of that parking ramp, benefiting the neighborhood, visitors, and an opportunity to create private investment to build on top of that structure, driving more economic development. Current model from some developers that bring forward are hotel and market rate apartments. With the medical district plan, we are partnering with the City of Duluth, neighborhood, and Essentia, building a more cohesive medical district and revitalizing the entire neighborhood. Additional public infrastructure will drive additional development, foster growth, and further development along the entire corridor. Our campus is also located in an opportunity zone, which makes it more attractive for private investment. Phase two of our campus expansion includes the expansion of a five-story medical office building, which would be next to Building A, completes the new foundation of our hospital, creates four levels of outpatient services, and one level of expanded surgical services. And phase three consists of a six-level inpatient tower, 216 patient beds, and we would keep 61 beds located in our current hospital. All private and flexible room design and efficient patient and staff flow. So on behalf of St. Luke's administration and board of directors, we are supporting this legislative act.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, do you have anything else or questions?
We have no more testifiers unless other people from the audience would like to testify.
I'm sure they don't. Questions? Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Schultz. Just a lot of material here, and just trying to bore down and get on the record to some of the costs. My understanding is you want $164 million from state general fund and state appropriation bonds. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're appropriation bonds because it's a public-private partnership. We cannot use GO bonds. So it's $164 million. That's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Representative Schultz, how much of that in this bonding cycle? Is that the whole thing?
No, I think there's trigger language, and I think it's only like $2 million in this bonding cycle that there would be debt on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz,
Erdahl.
That's appropriation?
General appropriation, correct. Okay.
So it's the general obligation bonds or appropriation bonds?
Appropriation bonds.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz, that's the state's share that you're talking about here. Where will the other funding come from?
The other funding will come from the city of Duluth in terms of their half-cent sales tax and then other funding through the parking structure revenue.
Madam Chair, no, thank you. Representative Schultz, so is it the total cost is $800 million?
Madam Chair, Representative, each hospital system is going to be making private investments. So Essentia has committed up to $800 million and St. Luke's up to $200 million of private investment. And we are seeking general appropriation bonds to help with the infrastructure build to make those private investments happen.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Torkelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I've heard some conversation comparing this to the Destination Medical Center procedure or process that was put in place for Rochester some time ago. Can you draw any parallels or comparisons between the two?
Sure. So thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson. So the Destination Medical Center in Rochester was asking for over, I believe, $500 million. So this is a much smaller scale. They were also seeking general appropriation bonds because they also had a public-private partnership arrangement. But we did, our city officials are reaching out to city officials in Rochester to find out what went well, what didn't go so well, so we don't make any mistakes along the way. And so that process is happening right now.
Representative Tarkles. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that they used general obligation bonds for the project?
No, general appropriation bonds.
Appropriation bonds. Mm-hmm. I don't think the general part of it is part of the normal nomenclature.
But oh, sorry.
Maybe I'm mistaken. So this is quite a bit smaller than Rochester, but the structure is similar?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, there is a governing board structure. I believe ours might be smaller than Rochester's governing board structure, but we do have different representatives on that governing board helping advise the city of Duluth on terms of the projects and the plans going forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Local value capture is something I'm not familiar with. Can you fill me in on that?
I might not be able to do that, but I can maybe phone a friend here, or maybe House Research can help answer that question.
Where did you hear that?
Well, I read it someplace.
Okay. Mr. Wally, help us out.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Wally, and I represent the city of Duluth. The value capture is actually a trigger that the state obligations for appropriations bonds don't kick in until there's been a certain level of investment that's been made by the private entities. And so both of these entities are intent on making the investment and, in fact, have done so, I don't know the exact level. That's the concept. The private investment has to trigger the public infrastructure bonds before we proceed with the project. And then there is some revenue capture at the local level. The parking ramps that will be built with this appropriations bonds, half of the revenue has to be dedicated to retiring the bonds that the state issues. And then there's a $250,000 a year appropriation from the city also going to the state to pay down the state bonds. So the city has some skin in the game as well.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you mentioned the parking ramp situation. I can't help but think of our parking ramp situation here in St. Paul, where the River Center parking ramp is actually falling apart, and there's been no revenue set aside to repair or replace it. Is that going to be a similar situation here in beautiful downtown Duluth?
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, we will strive to avoid that circumstance.
Thank you, Mr. Wally. Thank you, Madam Chair. So then the TIF district, can you tell me a little bit more detail about the TIF district that would be established?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, the TIF provisions that are in this bill are patterned after the TIF provisions that were provided in the Destination Medical Center legislation. That was something that we were advised to follow closely, that we didn't want to create a different form. So I can't recite for you the specific authority, but that was the basis upon which we proceeded, and I think that's a discussion that we'll have to have in the Tax Committee, which I think is our next stop for this bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, for tolerating a series of questions. I appreciate it. When I look at the map here that shows the medical district, I see that beyond the footprint of the two campuses, there's a number of blocks of the city of Duluth that are targeted. What's the relationship between those targeted parcels and the project?
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, I don't have a copy of that map in front of me. I see. You're addressing the borders of the medical district itself?
Well, it says on my map, land parcels targeted for private investment. I'm just curious if there's some kind of structure there that relates those parcels to this project, or it's just kind of a map that shows the impact of this development.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, the footprint that you see there, I think, is representative of ownership interests largely. There's quite a number of those blocks that are represented in this map that are owned by either St. Mary's Essentia or the nuns who... Sisters of St. Benedict own quite a number of blocks. Benedictine Sisters. And they own quite a bit of this property, and there's been discussions going on with the sisters about whether properties that they own might be appropriate for development for housing and other uses. And that's a conversation that will take some time to iron out, but I know that they're underway already.
Well, thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's been conversations. Is there some financial relationship between those parcels and this project, or is it just the physical proximity that is involved?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I believe there's been a relationship with the sisters and the medical system, the Essentia system in St. Mary's over the years. I don't know how intertwined those relationships are at this time, but I know historically they've been very closely tied.
Mr. Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson. There is a discernment group that has been formed with the Benedictine Sisters of St. Scholastica and Essentia to work through what will happen with the current St. Mary's Medical Center campus. And so that is in process and will take some time to work through kind of what will happen with that campus that we currently have. And there's a group formed to work through and look at various options for that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's all I have for the moment.
Okay. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This does sound familiar. The numbers are a little bit different, though, and just kind of visiting some of those. I'm just trying for clarification. Was it 2,200 employees between the whole hospital systems, all the hospital systems, or just one of the two? Okay, what's the total number of medical hospital employees then between the systems? So that would benefit from this legislation.
Madam Chair and Representative, as I noted, we have 14,500 individuals employed by Essentia. 6,700 of those are in Duluth Superior. Most are on our main campus for Essentia.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, St. Luke's employs slightly under 3,000 in St. Luke's health system.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Pearson.
I guess more direct. Thank you, Madam Chair. More directly, in this zone, then, approximately how many employees would be in this zone? Because, I know a lot of these health systems have far-reaching and specifically medical employees.
Madam Chair,
Representative Pearson. Mr. Wally.
It appears my arithmetic would say about 9,600.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. If things didn't go well in the Rochester model, the county is on the hook for the bonding dollars. In your model, I don't recall seeing that in the legislation. I did just do a skimming overview of it this weekend because we were still on spring break. So I apologize if it's blatantly laid out, but I'd appreciate maybe the public to be informed on who's on the hook if the bonding dollars aren't covered.
Madam Chair, Representative
Sam Schultz.
Pearson, the city or the state could issue the appropriation bonds. I believe.
Madam Chair, what does the bill? The bill just offers that as an opportunity for either of those?
Ms. Deason.
Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, as I read the bill, it authorizes the city to decide to require the state to issue state appropriation bonds, or the city can request a direct appropriation of general fund money based on the formula that's in the bill, but it's the whether or not the city issues bonds is separate from the general the state appropriation bonding.
So, Madam Chair, ultimately, thank you, Madam Chair. Ultimately, then, who's responsible for those bonds if things don't go well?
Ms. Deason.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, state appropriation bonds are paid from the state general fund, so it is the appropriate or the requirements in the bill for the city to make a payment of $250,000 per year. That just goes to the general fund. It's not a direct relationship to the payment of the appropriation bonds. Appropriation bonds are strictly backed by an appropriation from the state. So it's the state's contribution to the development project.
So, Madam Chair, that does sound like it's a little bit of a distinction between the two models that have been proposed here. So I guess I'm just wanting to make sure that people are aware of that minor distinction and of course, ultimately, the state is who grants all of that authority anyway from us being the type of charter state that we are. The counties and cities don't have all that much authority without the state anyhow. So ultimately, it's always the state that's on the hook. But here we've got certainly an additional liability there for the state of Minnesota. So the total amount that the state could be laying out would be $164 million. Am I reading that correctly?
Ms. Deason.
Madam Chair and Representative Pearson, I would defer to our fiscal analyst, but the debt service that is pledged to the repayment of of the appropriation bonds is up to $13,400,000 per year, but it's scaled so that at the beginning it would depend on how much an appropriation bonding is issued in any particular year, and then what kind of debt service would be. So it's sort of I understand it's kind of like a bell-shaped curve, but for more information on the numbers, I would defer to our fiscal analyst on the state requirements.
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair and Representative Pearson, if you look on the fiscal note for the bill on page 11, there's an explanation of the long-term fiscal considerations at the top of that page, and it shows the $164 million figure, which in the bill language is line 3.5, and then the estimated cost of repaying $164 million over the 20-year life of the bonds at about $268.4 million, which would then be offset by payments that the city makes to the state general fund. As I understand, the bill structure authorizes the total amount of appropriation bonds at $164 million, and then also sets the maximum debt service per year at $13.47 million. And if you're looking for that in the bill language, it is line 5.14. And that up to $13.47 million amount is in effect beginning in fiscal 2022 through 2055. So as bonds were issued, the total debt service payments, if the state were to issue the appropriation bonds, would go up to the maximum cap of $13.47 a year to pay back that debt. But the actual, and though that, so if you look on line 5.21, that payments can happen over that period, but it wouldn't necessarily be up to the $13.47 million, if that makes sense, every year.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
So what would the total costs be, then, of this $164 million of state investment?
Madam Chair and Representative Pearson, that is on page 11 of the fiscal note. MMB estimates that under the current authorization, that would be about $268.4 million over the life of the bonds for $164 million worth of debt. However, I should note that the $13.74 million would allow for more debt service than that, but right now with this level of authorization, MMB is estimating that $260 million number for the total life of the bonds for that authorization.
Madam Chair,
Representative Pearson,
and Madam Chair, I appreciate your patience. I certainly could take this offline, but maybe the full committee is
would be also interested in knowing how does that compare to the Rochester model then? If Mr. Lee wants to take a crack at that, I didn't ask anyone to prep for that tonight, but just getting that side-by-side analysis for me would be quite helpful. The campus, population, you're saying around 9,000, I believe Mayo Clinic is, and I have another rep, I think we're around 65, but 30,000, I think, is what the number is in Rochester on our medical campus. So, just trying to, kind of scale this. I don't, we're not comparing apples to apples by any means, but just a general understanding and a sense of some of that. And I don't necessarily need that tonight. I just don't think I think it begs the question and certainly an analysis of that. If it could be provided to us as this bill moves forward, I'd certainly appreciate that. In some ways, it's the discussion that we're having here is about growing a campus of a medical facility. And again, when the Rochester DMC was brought forward, another component or highlight of that was actually this model where we're actually attracting people from other countries and other states to our region and to our state. In some ways, I'm a little bit concerned within the model of what Essentia demonstrates that this is, certainly servicing an existing patient base, but the terminology of DMC or anything like that is has a loaded vernacular to it of bringing people in from other parts of the world in a competitive medical industry with the top providers in a global universe. Could anyone speak to what the anticipated patient impact, again, because we're talking about some of the fiscal analysis of this, but we're in a capital investment committee, I guess if I could have a little latitude of just kind of understanding what the patient impact of this would be too. Are we drawing, what's our model, or what's the intended growth model here? Are we just improving facilities? Are we increasing patient load? Are we increasing employee counts, FTE counts? The original modeling of the DMC for Rochester envisioned actually recapturing the state income tax of the added employees. That was an original pitch of what our model was down in Rochester, because the goal was to grow an industry within our state. And as I look at this, it's nice, and shiny new buildings are always wonderful, but with the state having to lay out this much money, I'm curious of what the actual benefits, the targeted benefits of are. We've got all these by the numbers on costs, but what are the by the numbers for the outcomes?
Mr. Hayward.
Madam Chair and Representative Pearson, we haven't talked through this, but we are seeing about a 3% growth rate in our patient base each year for Essentia. So we are attracting more patients throughout the region, throughout northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, and over into the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And this will be an attractor for patients throughout our region to come to this new facility with the care that we can provide in that new facility.
Mr. Boschwager.
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members. St. Luke's is similarly experiencing growth. I believe we had 17% growth last year, 112 FTEs. We're at capacity with the facility. We're serving three states of northern Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And this would help attract a workforce and sustain that growth, because right now we are at capacity. An example of that is our emergency room, where we have 14 bays, and we are tripling that in size. And so it has far-reaching impact.
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, going back to the question that you had about the comparison between the DMC and the Duluth Medical District model, we will get that information for you and try to do an apples-to-apples comparison so we can better understand the proportions here.
But Representative Schultz, I just want to put something in here. I don't think we quite understood especially on this map, and this one you referred to, you're talking more about the medical facility itself. That's going to be reduced in both places, I understand.
Madam Chair.
The footprint for the hospital itself and the hospital itself. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, yep. Essentia is consolidating in terms of their locations, but they're building a new hospital vertically. So they're trying to co-locate their clinics and hospitals in a smaller footprint, which would leave open more opportunities for infill and parking lots for housing or retail. But just remember that it's the hospitals that are building the new buildings. We're asking for state assistance to do the get the infrastructure ready for that district.
And also, the yellow bricks around here, the yellow spots on here, this is development land for primarily housing and different kinds of housing for all incomes and homes. And these are, a lot of the homes have already been torn out and done away with as they've expanded out and more and gotten more employees, so they need more parking, and so they took these houses. A first offer, you know, people came, won't you buy my house kind of stuff. That was back in the 90s, as I said. And we're waiting for the hospital to ask to buy our house, and then we'll go to cabin, or we'll go to assisted living, or we'll go south where the kids are, to Minneapolis, or Hermantown.
Well, know. Madam Chair.
And Hermantown's just up here.
Madam Chair.
It's over here, up here, you know, a little bit. And so this area is going to be revisioned. And there's going to be new opportunities for different kinds of community and neighborhood. And that's what the sisters part is doing. And that's they're not going to give up any of their new land or their land that they've had all these years unless it's just right for the community and the neighborhood and the diversity of the people in this area. It's not going to be high rises for the people that want to look over at the lake in a tower all the time. It's going to be real people with real kids, with real parents and grandparents all living together in a different way, in a new way, in a modern 21st century way. And Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Dyson, we have a limit for general obligation bonds. I don't think there's any such limit on appropriation bonds, is there?
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, again, that's a question for the fiscal analyst as to the debt capacity of the state and how that's calculated, because state appropriation bonds are part of that calculation. If you're asking, is there anything in the Constitution that says you can't do it beyond, there's nothing, there's no legal limit. It's a financial limit.
Right.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. You have something to add, Mr. Lee?
Madam Chair and
Mr.
Representative
Lee.
Erdahl, the state does have a limit on total principal outstanding for all state obligations. That includes general obligation debt, trunk highway debt, and all appropriation bonds or similar debt arrangements like lease purchase agreements or certificates of participation. So state appropriation bonds would be included within the state debt limit. Before 2009, there was a debt limit that applied only to general obligation bonds, and appropriation bonds were not included in that. But after MMB revised the state debt management policy guidelines in 2009, they brought in all state debt as counting towards that limit.
Okay, thank you. Might be interesting to see with this proposal what our capacity would be at that stage. And what is the, I know that appropriation bonds are more expensive. Do you know at the present time how much more?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, it depends on market conditions. There isn't really a good comparison because when the state goes to market for GO bonds or appropriation bonds, just a lot depends on the time that the bonds are sold, but also investors when evaluating interest rates, in addition to looking at the conditions in the market, evaluate the ability for the state or whatever entity is issuing the debt to pay back bonds. General obligation bonds tend to get a lower interest rate because there's a full faith and credit pledge of the state attached to those, whereas appropriation bonds have a statutory appropriation. So there's a little bit of difference there. But again, there isn't a set percentage rate of a differential because it really does depend on market conditions.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm trying to get my head around this whole project just because it's similar to DMC, but it's different. When I look at the $164 million and then the $268 million that could be issued over time, and I do the calculation of $6,250,000, which is the city's obligation from sources other than sales tax, and I do that over 20 years, that ends up being $125 million of that $268 million. So I'm just trying to understand that. And, when you talk about parking revenues, I'm not sure if we're talking about millions per year, if we're talking about tens of thousands per year, if you could speak to that. But let me get a few other things. Just keep a running total here. My understanding is Duluth is proposing a half-cent sales tax for transportation. Is that still true? And this half-cent would be on top of that? No? If you, one of you could sort of speak to that would be great to help me
Madam
understand
Chair, what's going on. Madam Chair, Representative Dean, there is no half-cent sales tax associated with this particular project, except for the fact that of the revenue that would be generated from the half-cent sales tax, up to $20 million could be used for street improvements within the district that's designated on that map that you have available. So that $20 million of street infrastructure is specifically provided for in the bill to be a city responsibility.
Okay.
Then there's a $250,000 general fund appropriation from the city. And then with the estimate for half of the parking revenue from two parking ramps is estimated to be $300,000 per year. So it comes out to be $7.5 million.
Okay. So Madam Chair, so that's sort of the city's contribution to the infrastructure costs associated with the project. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, you are correct.
Okay. And just, one of the things that is happening in Rochester, Madam Chair, is that housing is becoming a big deal. The cost of affordable housing is beginning to go up, and it's becoming very difficult. Have folks started to look at that relative to what would happen in Duluth, specific to this future expansion of the medical district, and what are the tools or the plans that the city's starting to think about well in advance instead of trying to react to something which, I'll tell you right now, it's going to be inevitable. It's going to happen. If you could just speak to that, and then I'll have one other last comment to that point.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I know that affordable housing is an issue that's very important to the mayor, and she's engaged in discussions with a number of the housing advocates within the city on this topic. I don't know.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Dean.
Representative Schultz.
So this is a consolidation of the footprint, so they're not going to be buying up housing in the sense that may be happening in Rochester. I'm not sure, but we're going to have more opportunities to infill with empty lots, parking lots mostly, for affordable housing rather than market rate housing. So the Mayor Larson, this is her number one priority is affordable housing for the next few years.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, I wasn't just talking about houses disappearing. I'm talking about a larger workforce and the pressure that has on housing as well. And my last question, does Essentia have any other campuses that they're saying they'll leave Duluth if they don't get money?
Mr. Hayward.
Representative, Madam Chair and Representative Dean, we do not see any other services leaving Duluth.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anything else? Okay. Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, my map wasn't colored, so can I borrow this? If Representative Torkelson will yield to a question.
He said okay.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, again, this map, as I look at a map like this, it is reminiscent, again, of what the Rochester model used, specifically going to the investments having to be within a very specific district. The private investment had to be from a very specific district, and then the public investment, whether that was local public investment or state public investment, it all had to be in that very specific zone. And is that what this map is representing? Because, I get that there's consolidation and a shrinking of the footprint. I get that. But is the bill speaking to a limitation of an area so that we can identify where these dollars are actually heading to?
Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, yes. The map that you see is where the public and the private dollars would be focused exclusively.
Very good, Madam Chair. Thank you. And so then just digging just a scotch further, the type of small amount in Japanese, I think. No, Korean. No, what is that?
Norwegian.
No, it's not Norwegian. Anyway, the actual infrastructure investment then that the state would be making, the parking ramp was referenced. Are there other specific examples of what type of infrastructure with the appropriation dollars we are bonding for?
Mr.
Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, there is a street alignment that's specifically referred to in the bill as a project that the district board, the medical district board, is supposed to examine specifically. I think it's 6th Avenue East, because that comes down the hill right by the new campus for Essentia. There's a access to the lake right below the two hospital campuses that is specifically mentioned as something that the board is supposed to examine. And then I can't remember if there was a third item as well. But these were items that are specifically named in the statute as being projects that the board is supposed to examine. They're not specifically authorized absent a review and approval or recommendation by that panel. But there are some of these specific items that are parking, street realignment, and the cap.
Utilities.
Oh, and utilities. Those are the items that are specifically identified in the bill as being the responsibility of the board to examine and make recommendations with respect to funding through the appropriations bond process.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you. And the parking ramp, oh, by the way, scotch is Japanese. And you made me question myself when you shook your head no, but it is Japanese. We looked it up quick. Sorry. So when we talk about the parking ramp specifically, there was a reference to Main Street retail within the parking ramp, which of course is a great model. How are we separating the appropriation funds from a single structure that would have multiple uses in an appropriation, Madam Chair?
Ms. Wally.
Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, I don't know how the parking ramp facilities will be structured relative to other commercial enterprises. at one point in the conversation on this bill, there was actually identification of the number of parking spaces, and that was actually left alone in favor of having this board interact with the parties and come up with a number, rather than in the statute saying thou shalt build 1,100 slots. And I think the notion of having that flexibility to negotiate the number of slots had to do with what the relationship would be to commercial enterprises who might avail themselves of those parking spots as well. But that's not something that's specified in the bill. It would be part of the discussions, I would imagine, with the folks who are on the board that's going to make recommendations with respect to those ultimate characteristics or factors for the parking ramps.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you for your patience, Madam Chair. I hope you have just a scotch more. I really just want to get that on the record, because I know certain communities have had issues with that in the past of appropriation dollars being used in kind of a mixed-use capacity, and we just have to make sure we're allocating these funds accordingly. I guess, I know you're speaking with representatives from the Rochester area, and I think all in all we're very pleased with the model. You know, it's a model that I think if imitation is the best form of flattery, we're very flattered that you're looking at this type of a model, and I'm wishing you very well on the endeavor. Overall, it's been a very successful process. My only cautionary tale, and this is a very editorializing specifically for you tonight, is that in many ways I feel like our state investment within our community of Rochester, while significant, and we're very grateful for it, we did get a lot of those funds with a lot of conditions. And including the board, a board that is made up, in my opinion, of a lot of people who are from outside of the community of Rochester, and we wanted that oversight. That was a big part of the whole discussion and the model. And I just would make sure, as you move forward, you make sure that you're able to retain the control that you need, so that the goals and objectives of your community are most strongly met. And, as you move forward, I would just be sure that you're keeping a lot of strength within your own community and how you're guiding your own path. In some ways, I think maybe Rochester might have gone a little too far the other direction. So that's my personal opinion, and not everyone from Rochester would share that at all. But that's my small piece of advice. And I thank you again, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Salk.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I'll take this opportunity to say that I would like to be a party to the dialogues that you may have with, in terms of added information, that sort of thing, because I have a lot of the same tracking questions as to structure and how it fits together and that sort of thing. I would differ, maybe in a minor way, as to outside influence. I thought that the makeup of the board that we experienced is probably the fertilizer for great ideas and great decisions. Some of those decisions came from the fact that people that were in the board came from paradigms outside of our paradigm and brought ideas then that would have not been organic. In fact, the board members that were organic oftentimes walked right past ideas, but the person from outside experiences were able to see and maybe harvest those ideas and bring them into function. I appreciate that Mark is nodding his head with his experience of participating during that time. I think that became very evident. And so I would offer that you do want to try to capture that as much as possible. And then I would also say that it's useful for you, I think, to try to have as much flexibility left for you, and that in that way, I think, agreeing with Representative Pearson, that sometimes the way ours is structured, it does stand in the way as being a little too concrete for us to be able to flex through the issues and or problems that may come up. I'm interested in one, maybe just an additional kind of your perspective on I'm also interested in the line that Representative Pearson took as to what is it that you're capturing? You know, I get that you're building a better facility, trying to remodel and bring the two operations together, and then end up with something that's going to function at a much higher level. But to some extent, is there a conceptualization, a concept of care or service that is yet out there that you're moving toward? I know that you may have, and I'm going to give you a free pass. You'll have to decide whether you're going to take it. One of the things is you're going to cannibalize yourself, and you have to be cautious about that, whether it's neighboring institutions and or that sort of thing. But I'm just going to give you a pass ticket on that and allow you to say it, and hopefully everybody would forgive because the legislator was making you say it. But there must be something that you're also going out to capture and or produce better than the public is experiencing at this point.
Mr. Hayward.
Yep. Madam Chair and Representative Sock, thank you for the question. Our goals for Vision Northland are to really bring our campus together to gain efficiencies, to gain a better patient experience, to really improve the care that we offer to our patients in our community. Much of this is a new hospital bed tower, which will have private rooms, which will have really the best of our surgical suites. So bringing that campus together will create efficiencies, will create a better experience for our patients and better value for our patients. So just like Mayo Clinic, we're striving to, again, improve value, improve outcomes, reduce cost, and improve the satisfaction and experience of our patients. That's the goal that we have. Our campus is a large campus downtown. It's a large tertiary center. It has all the services of any large tertiary center except for transplant. So we offer all the services, and we want those to be efficient, to be well-run, to be high value for our patients that we serve and the communities that we serve. You brought up that I was at Mayo Clinic for 28 years. I was part of Destination Medical Center in some ways. There are some very similar parts to that that are part of what we're doing here. Part of that is economic development. This will spur economic development. We've already seen that happening in Duluth. We expect much more to happen, as also happened in Rochester, and that economic engine that it creates. We see growth. We've talked about growth. It's different growth than you'll see in Rochester, clearly. We're attracting patients from Canada, maybe not from the Middle East or from Europe, but we're attracting patients from across our region. It's different growth, but it's growth, and it's growth of patients who need our services and really will benefit greatly from our services. So I can't say it's the same. I've been at Mayo for 28 years. I've been here for 4 years. Very different markets that are served, but they're both very, very important markets for our communities, for the patients that we serve. I will say it's also infrastructure. Destination Medical Center had a big part for infrastructure, for transportation, for hubs, for just how the whole community fit together in the different parts of the downtown community. This is part of that, to increase the medical district. It's very much about a medical district and creating an infrastructure in that medical district to support that medical investment, that private investment that will spur, it really has to happen before we see any public investment. So thresholds have to be met of private investment to then spur, or to be supported by public investment, a very similar model. And those are in the bill, overseen by an advisory board that will make good decisions about how that money is spent. You can debate who should be on that, as I heard you debating already, who should be part of that and how that makeup should be. But that's very similar. There is a unique component to this that Chair Murphy talked about, which is consolidating our campus to be able to put space that we've used to grow our campus over time back into other services, like housing, like other services that will support a Central Hillside neighborhood, which, you know, really needs support to have housing, to have vibrancy, to have what we want to have in that neighborhood, which does not always have that. So that's a very different thing than I saw in some of what happened in DMC, just to be clear.
Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at this map, I'm wondering if any of the new infrastructure that would be involved in this is closer to the lake or closer to the lake walk than is currently in place. And if so, how have you accounted or what are you doing to account for some of the weather-related disasters that we've seen lately in that area?
Madam Chair, Wally.
Representative Sandstedt, I don't believe there'll be any infrastructure that will be down by the lake walk itself. One piece of infrastructure that has been considered, and it's still in the bill, and it would still be for discussion by the board as to whether it would be recommended for financing or not, and that is putting a cover over the interstate as it opens up on the stretch going east and up the shore, and that would provide access down to the water. But that's not in a proximity to the lake itself that would cause it to be vulnerable to the storms, and that's a separate issue of having the back-to-back storms in the last year that undid the lake walk substantially.
Thank you.
I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1216 as amended be referred to Ways and Means for further discussion.
Oh, good job.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple more quick questions, if I may.
Get them in.
I know you're trying to
get them. This is your chance.
First, the bill describes a regional exchange district. Does that include the blue and yellow squares on this map?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes.
Thank you. And that is the district that the board would have jurisdiction over and in which they would invest this $164 million of state money?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes.
And the restrictions on those investments are described in the bill, but they seem quite broad as to what they can utilize those funds for. Is that correct?
Yes. Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, yes, that's true, too.
I believe the state can only issue bonds for a life of 20 years. This bill appropriates money that's available through the year 2055. That would mean that the potentially you'd still be issuing bonds in the year 2035. Is that correct?
Ms. Deason.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, the 20-year limit is a constitutional limit on state general obligation bonds, and so the bill can specify longer term for appropriation bonds, and that's what I was just looking for to see what the terms are, but the but there's not a constitutional limit on the term of bonds for state appropriation bonds.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Ms. Deason, is there no limit on the term of appropriation bonds?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, on page 2, line 13, the bonds are 25-year term bonds.
25 years. So then we'd be at the year 2030 would be the last possible date for this board to issue a bond. Is that correct? No. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I didn't mean to bypass you.
Ms. Deason.
Madam Chair, as I understand the bill, the bonds would be could be up to 25-year in term, but the how long they can be issued is going to be governed more by the limit on how many years debt service can be appropriated for it, and that goes through 2055.
Yes, Madam Chair, so that would mean they could issue a bond in 2030 and still be in the 25-year limit.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. The bill talks about no public bidding, less public bidding exemption on projects within the improvement district. Can the author explain the reasoning for that?
Representative Schultz.
Madam Chair, can you repeat the question, Representative Torkelson?
In Section 10 of the bill, there is a public bidding exemption. Line 15.14.
Does that have to do with that Magoo's already been picked, Mr. Hayward?
Madam Chair, I think this is the parking garage competitive bidding. Oh.
Madam Chair,
I
think the language is pretty clear that it's the parking facility or other public improvements constructed in conjunction with the parking facility. So I think that's specific to the parking facility currently. I don't know if that applies to all of the public infrastructure within the project area.
Madam Chair?
Well,
Mr. Wally.
It's because that parking ramp needs to be bid in conjunction with the Essentia investment of their initial funds because it's tied to the Essentia facility, or it relates in proximity to the facility. So we needed that parking facility to be tied to their process, their bidding process.
Mr. Torkelson.
I think I got that, Madam Chair. We'll probably ask some more questions when we get to Ways and Means, Madam Chair.
I think that's a good idea. Mr. Cervanek, did you come down? Okay. All in favor of the Murphy motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted, and it's on its way to Ways and Means. We're reverting back to the last testimonies that you will receive, she said, hopefully, giving us advice about our priorities and determining our how we're going to make our $1.5 billion target, or how we're going to make our $845 million target. And a couple of you have reminded me that I didn't give you a separate target for cash. And I will tell you that I'm willing to share that too. And so you can have up to $4.5 million of cash to figure in those cash asks on your homework, on your spreadsheets. But you will be needing your spreadsheets tomorrow when you come at 8 o'clock or just before 8 o'clock. So we're all set to go at 8 o'clock. But tonight we're going to hear from people we haven't heard from before for the most part, and then one or two people that want one last chance at us. We're sticking with the 5-minute time periods. And the first item on, the first person is Liz Connor from Minnesota Management and Budget. Ms. Connor? Oh, we're asking you to come because we haven't heard especially about the governor's Article 2 on the governor's budget recommendations. And we hear you're the best person to tell us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I think when Commissioner Franz was here, he gave a pretty thorough overview of the appropriations in Article 1 and the priorities in the governor's bill. So if by any chance if anyone has a copy of the governor's bill, which is, I don't have the House file number on hand, 2704. I'll just quickly walk through the various sections in Article 2. So the first section relates to negotiated bond sale authority for Minnesota Management and Budget. It is authority that has been authorized in the past, but it expired on June 30th of 2018. It would provide MMB the authority to issue RFPs to create a pool of possible investment banks to bid on the state's bond sale. Section 2 is the authorizing language for the facilities capital program that would facilitate the appropriation for the facilities capital program in Article 1 of the bill. Section 3, 4 and 5 relate to requirements that would attach to capital projects. These are already requirements that exists for state agencies, and this would extend it to local projects as well, that projects would have to comply with workforce participation and equal pay requirements in Minnesota statutes, Chapter 363. Section 6 is the authorization of the $120 million of appropriation bonds for the Housing Finance Agency for housing infrastructure bonds. And Section 7 provides the debt service appropriation for that authorization. Section 8 would provide for the repurposing of the unspent balance from an appropriation made in 2017 for the Minneapolis Veterans Home, a project on the on that campus for a trust fund, a trust bridge, that the unspent portion would be available for asset preservation for the department. And sections 9 and 10 simply amend the total agency appropriations for the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. You might recall from the 2018 bonding bill, there were appropriations made in both Article 1 and Article 3 of that bill, and there was inconsistent treatment in how the total agency appropriations were written into the bill. For some agencies, they had their appropriations were the net of those two articles, and for others, it was not the net effect of those two articles. So this would treat all agencies the same way, which would consider both the appropriations and the reductions made in Articles 1 and 3 of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Connor. How much is left of the trust bridge?
I don't have, Madam Chair, that amount left over. I'm not sure if there's anyone here from the department who might know what that balance is.
Mr. Johnson? Do you know? No. Mr. Wasloski?
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Wayne Wasloski with the Department of Administration, Real Estate and Construction Services. It's approximately $4 million is currently left, although the work on the bridge is not yet completed. So it's still ongoing.
Okay. Ms. Dyson, did you have questions about negotiated bonds or? Okay. Okay, any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Connor.
Thank you.
Stay there, Mr. Wasloski. Give us your pitch.
Madam Chair, members, again, for the record, Wayne Wasloski, Department of Administration, certainly appreciate the opportunity to present the recommendations for the department. First up is the Capital Asset Preservation and Replacement Account. This is an ongoing appropriation that we have in bonding bills. The recommended amount is for $10 million. This funds emergency repairs and hazardous materials abatement at state facilities. It ensures that after either damage from weather events or other types of equipment failures happen at our state facilities that we can quickly return them to operation. Demand for these emergency funds have been growing due to the increasing age of our state facilities and limited funding for preventative maintenance. Examples of past CAPRA uses include asbestos abatement, emergency roof, pipe and structural repairs, fire and water damage repairs, and replacement of failed air conditioning, boiler, and water units. The second request is a general fund request for $1.5 million. This is to develop a new real estate strategic plan for locating state agencies. The previous plan is completely outdated. It dates back to 1993. Many of the recommendations from that plan were implemented over the years. What the strategic plan provides is for a basis for making sound real estate decisions on owning, building, and leasing for locating state agencies. The last request we have is the Ford Building site redevelopment. That is a request for $1.5 million. This Ford Building is, as many know, is located just east of Rice Street on the Capitol campus. It has been vacant since 2003 due to deterioration and need for major repairs. The vacant building is located on prime real estate on the Capitol campus, and over the years, since it's been a vacant, has accumulated over $1 million in costs to keep it maintained. The project would allow for redevelopment of that site. The Ford Building itself is about 57,000 square feet of space, and it's connected onto the tunnel system. You can get approximately on the site available about a 450,000 square foot building on that site. And that strategic plan would be used to determine what is the best use of that site going forward. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Where will you move the Ford Building to?
Madam Chair, the proposal is to demolish the Ford Building.
Oh, that's a different word than remove.
Oh, than remove?
I see. Thanks. Remove on this page. Oh. Demolish.
Oh. Yeah, we were using it interchangeably, Madam Chair.
Chair likes the Ford Building.
Don't put a roundabout there.
You might need your canvas bag back. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And please save some bricks for Representative Loeffler. Madam Chair, Mr. Wazowski, long range, I'd like to get into just a little bit. I know in the past there's been discussion about doing something about the venerable structure that we're in right now. Is there anything down the road, any plans for the SOB?
Mr. Wazlowski.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, thank you for the question. We view this building as one of the, from a condition standpoint, constructed in 1932. It has many of the same issues that the Capitol building had, from the mechanical systems, the plumbing systems, life safety. It really is in need of comprehensive repair work. Now, the question really is we're ready when folks are ready to take on that challenge, and we understand that's a significant challenge, but certainly it's going to be inevitable. You've already had a situation a few years back in 2016 where there was a pipe break and caused significant damage in the building. You're going to see those type of events happen if we don't take a comprehensive approach to its repair.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Pearson.
Madam Chair, I guess, you know, again, the Ford Building does come up in this committee quite a bit, and I don't know if you've been tracking that or not. If the state of Minnesota were to construct a building of that nature, would they ever build it so strong and so solid that it would stand as long as the Ford Building is going to if we don't demolish the Ford Building?
Mr. Wazlowski.
Mr. Chair, the structure itself, it was built to last a very long time, but it's the roofing systems, the mechanical systems, the plumbing systems, all the building things that you need to operate a building that are completely either no longer even there or beyond their useful life. The roof is leaking as we speak. So you just have these ongoing costs that even vacant buildings, you're incurring costs to deal with safety issues.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And why aren't the mechanical systems still in place in the Ford Building?
Madam Chair, Representative, in 2003, those systems were no longer functioning and you needed to make a major investment in the building at that time to have an operating systems, both from a life safety standpoint, from a mechanical plumbing. The building needed wholesale restoration at that point. So far, the direction on that, there isn't consensus on how that building should be handled.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
I guess I'll just editorialize just a fraction here, because again, the amount of energy that goes into constructing a building is makes that building the most efficient building that we can ever construct again, and putting those materials in landfill and putting that energy into what I would actually determine as significantly historically significant to the city of St. Paul and our state as the Capitol itself. I mean, it's of the same campus, it's of the same era, it demonstrates so much of what this this region and this campus has been, was, and I think can be and will be. And I will continue to express that opinion as it pertains to that specific building and the neglect. And again, when we have private property owners that neglect a historical structure in an area, we hear a lot of public outcry. The state of Minnesota has neglected that building since 2003, and while we may not have had a plan, it's long overdue to consider all options, and at this point I feel like all opportunities and options have not been exhausted with that building, and I do not support that specific position. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Wasilowski, you gave two figures, the square footage of the Ford building and then the square footage of the new building.
Madam Chair, the existing building is about 57,000 square feet. The site capacity is around 450,000 or so, depending on how you handle a parking facility on that site as well. Madam Chair, just to be clear, that's not just the footprint of the building. That is using that entire site that surrounds it, the surface parking lot that's adjacent to the building.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Wasilowski, sitting on the CAP board, I'm curious that we don't do the real estate strategic plan sort of as a regular thing, and we probably should. Looking at that in the future, I think coming for $1.5 million is like a huge ask for something at a time when, you know, there's some reluctance on bonding here at the state. And I'll just remind my colleague that in 2003, you know, the state was just about entering into a hard time where finding money for maintenance and operations on buildings were really, really difficult. And we've seen a lot of deferred maintenance. We're seeing a lot of HEPR money on state-owned buildings, but yet we can't seem to get the money available to make sure that those buildings are kept at the level they could be to extend their lives. So I think that, you know, it's easy to say that, you know, the state failed, but it wasn't just like, you know, Department of Administration that failed. It's like we failed as a whole state by not funding those systems to make sure that those systems work, by not funding the new roof when a roof started to leak, by not funding those things at the time. And you reach a point where you stop funding those maintenance things that ultimately it makes it much, much more expensive to go back in and redo the systems in a building, to redo some of the structure that needs to be done to get the amount of square footage. And I, you know, I just commend, and this is truly, this isn't an April Fool's joke, Representative Pearson, in thinking about the landfill, thinking the amount of embodied energy that goes in creating new buildings, because those are all things that we often don't talk about here. And those are critical things that we need to be thinking about. So let's make sure that we're doing a good job of taking care of the buildings that we do have and trying to identify early when we need to remove a building and reconstruct a building so that we don't increase significant, much, much more significant costs in the future when it comes time to do that. So I just hope that going back to the strategic plan, that this is something that gets incorporated long-term and not just a one-time thing where we say that it's been 25 years since we looked at this. It should never be 25 years since we've looked at a real estate strategic plan for the campus and the needs of the state relative to the department administration. It was more of a comment than a question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. I'd just like to go back to this building for one moment. Mr. Wasilowski, when was this building remodeled, such as this particular room that we're in?
Mr. Wasilowski.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I believe it was in the early 70s. I don't know that. No, I'm getting corrected. I think somebody might have better information than I do.
Madam Chair and representatives, I believe it was 1985, 1986.
1985. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wasilowski, is that more than 25 years ago?
Yes. I was in parking lot D before that. Yes.
I can do the math.
Okay, Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just thinking back to the Ford building again. You know, Fords were actually constructed there, I'm told. That's why it's called
on each
Ford.
Floor.
Yeah. And we have a history
strong
in Minnesota
Ford.
Of being a manufacturing location for Ford up until not too long ago. And so I think we need a museum. So I'll turn it into a museum, starting with the Model T.
And get legacy money.
I'll let that... Let somebody figure that part of it out.
Move it to Fergus Falls.
You can do that. We've got a building that would be big enough, too. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I think we're around 5 minutes on this.
Thank you, Member.
Agriculture and Health Laboratory. Followed by Veterans Affairs. Ms. Shaw, Ms. Barkas, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Breanne Shaw. I'm the technical manager in the Laboratory Services Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And with me is...
I'm Dr. Joanne Barkas. I am the director of the Public Health Laboratory at the Minnesota Department of Health.
So we're here today to talk about a joint project between the Minnesota Department of Health and Agriculture. We're seeking capital funding of $19.9 million to correct safety, energy, and operational efficiency problems at the MDA-MDH laboratory building here in St. Paul. And that's to address architectural, mechanical, electrical improvements that are needed throughout the building to support critical laboratory testing in the areas of emergency response, food safety, infectious diseases, homeland security, and environmental contaminants. So a little bit of background. So our building was completed in 2005. In 2014, there was a series of mechanical failures after a very cold couple of days that caused the pipes in our building to freeze and then burst. The flooding caused about $1 million in damages in our laboratory. Following that flooding event, along with the Department of Health, the Department of Ag, and admin, we commissioned a retrocommissioning study to look into the building to see if there were any additional issues that they could see there. And they really focused on mechanical systems, so heating, cooling, ductwork, exhaust, and electrical systems, power and distribution. And they identified a number of problems. One of them was deteriorated ductwork. So if you look at the handout you have there, if you go in, I believe it's page 3 or 4, you'll see a picture of some of that deteriorated ductwork that is on the second floor of our laboratory. So that is one of the issues they identified. Also things like our general exhaust capability. We have air pressure control issues. We have problems monitoring our air pressure. And then there are some of our building components that need to be replaced or repaired. So I guess the reason that this is so important to us is we play a critical role in protecting human health, the environment, and the agriculture economy. And much of the testing that we perform in our laboratories is not performed in any other laboratories. And so it requires the use of sophisticated and up-to-date equipment, but also facilities. So in order to maintain these capabilities, we need to correct the concerns that have been identified in this retrocommissioning study to basically ensure that our building is going to meet current functionality requirements and that we can continue to operate safely and efficiently well into the future.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to basically support and reinforce what my colleague from Agriculture has stated. This building is really important in protecting the safety of the people that work in the building. That is of paramount importance. And it's these HVAC systems, the electrical, that help protect the people that work in the building and, of course, the people outside of the building as well. You know, as Brianne mentioned, we have had some issues with the building because of the technical difficulties in trying to maintain that directional airflow. And I would be remiss if I didn't tell you the story of what I affectionately refer to as the big suck. When our building became so negatively pressured that we could not open the doors to the building, and it actually sucked the toilets dry. That happened a while ago, and we haven't had quite that anything to that extent. But as also was mentioned in 2014, January 6th, 2014, which lives in infamy in my mind because it was the day that we were in the midst of the polar vortex, and due to a number of system failures, cold air was entrained into the building, and it resulted in probably 23 small waterfalls in the building, resulting in over $1 million of damage to the Department of Health laboratories. So as has been mentioned, we've identified a number of other issues that need to be repaired. And so we're asking for $19.9 million plus $720,000 in costs associated with moving equipment during the construction of the building. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is this the same lab that was on fifth floor when I got here? Of the fifth floor of the SOB? That egg lab that was up there? And smelled all the time.
Madam Chair, I don't believe so. No, the Department of Agriculture laboratory actually used to be down off Plato Boulevard. We were co-located with the regulatory division.
Okay. Did they have a lab down there now?
No.
No. And so this is the only lab, the health one? How did all that stuff happen, Mr. Weslowski?
We were hoping he wasn't going to leave us.
I mean, this sounds like a new building that's disastrous.
Not even 25 years old.
Yeah, not even 25 years old. How can that happen?
Madam Chair, members.
Without it, I bet it's because we didn't have a plan. Go ahead.
Yeah, for the record, Wayne
Before
was.
Before your time.
Yes. Yeah. It was, Madam Chair, but for the record, Wayne Wislowski with the Department of Administration. This, as I think you're getting the sense, is not a typical facility that we operate. It is the technology, the lab equipment that is utilized in this facility has many unique requirements, as they mentioned, both to protect the safety of the folks that work there and to also to be able to get licensed in the way that they need to do the testing. Going back through the records as we did when we started encountering these situations, it's not clear. There's obviously an interaction that's happening between the budget that was set for the project. It was a $60 million budget and everything that was trying to get accomplished within those funds. So It certainly seems evident that the budget played a part. An example of that is the ductwork. If you had used stainless steel, they use stainless steel in a number of the branches that go to specific lab equipment. One consideration you can see going back and forth in the correspondence is using stainless steel throughout the ductwork throughout the building. The only reason you wouldn't do that in this type of facility, in my mind, would be because of budget. You couldn't afford it. The other unique aspect is you bring in 100% fresh air. So you have this system where you have a polar vortex happening and you're bringing 100% fresh air into the facility. That's where you started getting pipes freezing and water damage happening. So, I think the last factor is technology has changed pretty significantly related to lab operations of this nature over the last 15 years. So there's part of this is upgrades, part of this is doing things differently that appear to should have been done differently right from the start. But there's also a significant component of doing upgrades to meet current requirements as well.
Okay, I guess time's up.
Perfect.
Representative Pearson?
Madam Chair, thank you. When I first was sworn in, I took the tour of this, and this probably shocked and amazed me more than any deficiency of government capacity in my early awareness of government capacity. The fact that a building that was eight years old at the time had these deficiencies, and I still haven't gotten answers to some questions that I need to be more persistent, but now you're here. So I'm struck even by your statement now of saying that, you know, the budget was the impact, and I guess an engineer got paid. And it's kind of a twofold question of something as basic as what you were just referencing, the fact that we did not use stainless steel ductwork. Was that a practice at the time in other high-tech laboratory facilities in that era? Would other facilities have even considered using anything but stainless in 2006 when this was a brand new facility being built? Wouldn't that have been something that would have been pretty much standard issue and the only option to consider? Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Wasilewski.
So the design firm that was selected to do this, they competed to submit proposals, and they concluded on their team a national laboratory expert. And as part of that process, they were using CDC, Center for Disease Control, recommendations and guidelines as well. The part of that answer is what's required based on the testing that you're going to be conducting. And so, folks at the table could possibly talk to that. But it wasn't required to do the type of testing that was going to be conducted at the time. Obviously, that changed that decision to not go with stainless steel throughout the facility. Didn't keep up with the how the lab was used for those.
Madam Chair,
Dr.
Farkas, the problem with the ductwork that is deteriorating is happening over what we refer to as our clean metals laboratory. So one of the test suites of testing that we do is to detect heavy metals in a number of different samples, including water, human clinical samples, soil, whatever, and very sensitive methods. So we have a clean metals laboratory. When you're doing the testing for metals, you do an acid digestion. So that's done in a hood, so the acid is sucked up into the hood And when there's condensation in the ductwork, it essentially forms acid rain. And we actually did a number of years ago already, probably, 8 or 9 years ago, had to replace the ductwork over the clean metals lab because rusty water was coming through the ceiling in the clean metals lab. What seems to have happened in the construction is for the rest of the building, you probably don't need stainless steel. So they put stainless steel in the branch ducts, kind of making an assumption, I'm hoping based on calculations, of how far this acid rain would travel, and I think it was probably a little bit of a miscalculation. And that is where, it's where we do the metals digestion that we are now seeing the still seeing the corrosion, but it's a little bit farther even down the pipeline. So I don't know that I can answer the question of whether it's in other laboratories they're all stainless steel, but I think that's what went into the discussion or the calculation is because of the work that we were doing and the estimation of where it was going to travel to.
Madam Chair. So at some point, an engineer was paid to calculate that, and then we chose to exceed the calculations of the capacity of what we had in that system. Is that actually a more accurate statement? Because, I've always been thinking that we wrote a cause of action against the engineer, or, it was their responsibility. But it sounds like we tested beyond the calculations of the capacity of the system.
Dr. Barkas.
Madam Chair, I don't know that I can answer that. What I have seen is that the design was the laboratory is built as it was designed. So however that estimation was done, that was what was signed off on.
There's a building connected to the tunnel that's available. Thank you. Thank you, someone got that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, I hear you want to talk to us.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Chair Murphy, members of the committee, my name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. In the interest of brevity, I will make my remarks short. Governor is recommending $10 million for department-wide asset preservation. MDVA uses asset preservation funding to maintain and repair more than 1 million square feet of facilities spread over 64 buildings, some of which are more than 120 years old. Including 9 which provide 24/7 skilled nursing care. We provide skilled and domiciliary care for veterans and eligible spouses, and it's critical that MDVA is able to provide upkeep for these facilities to protect not only residents but their families, our guests, and our staff. We've identified items on our asset preservation list as critical in level 1 of the asset preservation list, or level 2 is unacceptable and featuring potential for failure. We've also identified an opportunity at the Minneapolis campus, and with this I'd like to highlight a specific request. This project is identified as Building 6, which is a historic structure at Minneapolis. Dates back to the active use more than 120 years, 1887. So this is not a recent building that's failing. This is an old building that has some failures. Has some major mechanical systems that have failed and are in need of replacement, and the current configuration of the building is outdated and doesn't meet current VA standards for care. The fire system is antiquated and it's not tied into the rest of the campus. As a result, this building is currently vacant. It was housing residents, and we moved those residents into a brand new building on campus. We're looking for support to potentially outfit this building with up to 36 beds of assisted living or skilled nursing care through the course of renovation. Funding for Building 6 could also be tied into support from the federal VA, so we would be able to leverage asset preservation dollars into federal funding as well. The renovated spaces would meet all state and federal requirements for skilled nursing or assisted living. Integration of fire systems at Building 6 would allow a quick response and minimize potential fires. Yeah. Would also allow us an opportunity to create a dedicated training space, which would improve our employees' basic skills training and continuing education. Would also allow us to continue our partnerships with St. Catharines University and other institutions of higher learning in Minnesota, hoping to train the next generation of caregivers for our facilities. I will leave it at that. I would just I'd like to thank this body for the continuous support over the last 15 years. We've been really successful in some capacity in terms of adding the potential for new homes, but it is imperative that we continue to invest in our existing infrastructure, including the historic campus at Minneapolis. Thank you.
Representative Jurgens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, good to see you here. Could you kind of give us an idea of what some of the priorities at the Hastings Veterans Home would be? I had the opportunity that was there just Friday for the Vietnam Veterans service, and as you know, I get an opportunity to go there a couple times a year, and I do know that there is a backlog on the deferred maintenance there, so maybe you could just help us out with that.
Certainly.
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I don't have the most recent update on the itemized list. We were able to utilize funding from the last round of capital investment funding to identify some, to take care of some of the tier one issues, but we are continuing to invest in that campus and bring it up to date. I know Building 25, which is below the public road, is one of the areas that we've invested some significant resources. And we're always dealing with issues in the steam and supply tunnels. The powerhouse of the campus is down the hill from the buildings that our residents live in primarily. So bringing that steam and water supply up the hill through a tunnel, there's constant degradation of that space as well. So.
Thank you. And I couldn't remember. I knew that there was some from last year, but I didn't know how far that money went as far as the asset preservation there. So thank you.
Could you provide a list for us in the future?
Chair, absolutely. Yeah.
Tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Okay, thanks. Mr. McKinnon, Department of Employment and Economic Development, followed by Mr. Meyer, Natural Resources. Mr. McKinnon?
Good
lots
evening.
Of stuff on our
good evening, Madam Chair.
From your department or about your department. Good. So it's good that you came in.
Good evening. Thank you for this opportunity to present Deeds Capital Budget Investment Request. My name is Kevin McKinnon. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Economic Development at Deed. I do have a PowerPoint here that, as it comes up, we'll talk about. There it comes. You can move slides. Just to talk about our requests here. Our requests are focused on ensuring that Minnesota communities have the resources they need to support economic development, business growth, and job creation, ultimately increasing the tax base of our communities. We have two, the Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program, or BDPI, at $3 million, and the Innovative Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program at $2 million. By making these resources available, we will continue to have funding available to support our communities as they compete for businesses that create jobs, increase the local tax base, and expand opportunities, particularly in greater Minnesota. The first one is our BDPI program, Business Development Public Infrastructure. This program is only available in greater Minnesota cities outside of the seven-county metro area and pays up for up to 50% of the eligible public infrastructure costs, not to exceed $2 million in a two-year funding period. The types of projects that these do are supporting business expansions. We help create industrial parks across the state. Eligible projects must be publicly owned infrastructure, which may include wastewater collection, drinking water, storm sewers, utility extensions, and streets. Eligible business projects that we support through this are manufacturing, technology, warehousing, distribution, and agricultural processing. Currently, we have about $6 million in our BDPI program that is available across the state. We are, at this time, reviewing $3 million worth of requests, which we expect to award here shortly. And there's also an additional $2.5 million of projects that we're talking to and expect applications from. So we need these resources to adequately support the opportunities that are before the communities today and in the coming year. One good example of a recent project that we funded was Daikin, which is a manufacturing company in Faribault. We provided $1 million to extend water and sewer necessary to support their expansion, which was a $40, $50 million investment that retained 500 jobs and created 132 new ones. Our second request is for the Innovative Business Development Public Infrastructure Program, or IDBPI. Sorry with the acronyms, but this program assists businesses that are engaged in or committed to engage in innovation, including high-tech R&D and new proprietary technology. It's very similar to the BDPI program in that we provide funding for eligible public infrastructure costs to support businesses that are in innovative industries. Again, grants may not exceed the lesser cost of the public infrastructure, 50% of the cost of the infrastructure. This program, like BDPI, funds drinking water systems, sewers, utility extensions, those types of things. We currently have about $1.3 million available and expect to award those funds very shortly as well. This program is actually available statewide, so we can do projects in the metro with this program, but we have done projects statewide with this funding. So with that, Madam Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Do you get to pick them, or do we?
You can.
You want? No, we can?
You can pick the questions.
The project.
Madam Chair, the communities make applications to us, and yes, we award funding based on what the projects are, how they meet the bond requirements, and those types of things. Yes.
So you want to point out to me and our committee members, every single committee member that's sitting here, that you want the $3 million and the $3 million and the $2 million and the $2 million. You want that, those dollars from us, and then the people that stood here before us and got their name on the spreadsheet, they apply to you and you pick whether they're going to get it or not. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members, the projects that come before us are generally business related, unless a community is developing an infrastructure or an industrial park. So there has to be a business tied to the expansion. So if you've got
economic development,
right. And yes, they are competitive. So we accept applications on a rolling cycle. We award on a rolling cycle as well.
And what is the amount of money that you would like us to put down for you?
So with the BDPI program, Madam Chair, BDPI program, we're asking for $3 million to get us through the next year, and $2 million for the IBDPI program as well.
So it's just $5 million?
$5 million total, yes.
Okay. Now, what did you think about the projects on the spreadsheet under deed?
Madam Chair, members, we generally don't take a position on the projects. Obviously, every year we receive 25 to 30 or so from this committee, or we have in the past 3 years, and we administer those and transfer the funds, obviously, to the cities. Units of government that administer the programs.
And you don't take a position on there?
Madam Chair, we do not.
And do you look for a certain questions that have to be answered before you administer them?
Madam Chair, members, yes, generally what happens is if there is a direct appropriation for a project, we will ask them to provide us a number of information points on basically what the project is, how it's going to be laid out, what are the sources of funding, do you have a match, those types of things, and we work with Minnesota Management and Budget on that as well.
Okay. Same kind of questions I was asking when they came before us, right? So what if we funded those but didn't fund the $3 million and the $2 million?
Madam Chair and members, that is obviously in your capacity. We're asking for $5 million for our programs, which are basically in support of communities to support their business activities that they are endeavoring. These are the programs that we run versus the direct appropriations that we receive.
Do people come to you and lobby you for their programs that before you, when they apply for their thing, then they follow up and say, come down and tell you a little more about the project, like they come here and tell us a little more about the project?
Madam Chair, members, generally the communities will bring us in, obviously, if they have a business expansion for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they don't need infrastructure, but when they do, this is a program that they would access, yes.
Representative Sansed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think your questions were in line with what I was going to ask, basically wondering if you have some kind of a ranking system like PFA does in prioritizing how you award those.
Ms. McKenna.
Madam Chair, members, we do not have a priority system or a ranking system per se. It is a rolling application cycle, so when there are business expansions in certain parts of the state, this is the program that we use to help communities offset the infrastructure costs to support that business expansion. Generally, there is funding. As I mentioned, there's $6 million today in the BDPI program. We've got $3 million in request, and we know about another 2.5 are coming. So at this point, we can fund what's out there.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Meyer. Mr. Meyer.
Good afternoon, Madam. Good evening, I should say, Madam. Yes. Thank you for the opportunity. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for the opportunity for us to present our capital budget request to you in the previous committee hearings they've had. I just wanted to take the opportunity today to highlight a couple of things that are out there. As you're well aware, the DNR manages over $3 billion in non-land capital assets. This requires a bonding program that includes funding for several aspects of capital asset management. Each funding area functions like its own program with project prioritizations. Funding across these areas is needed to adequately meet our capital improvement needs. That said, among our major categories, natural resource asset preservation is the DNR's top bonding priority. The NRAP, or Natural Resource Asset Program funding, is the foundation of our capital asset management program and is crucial to maintaining and renewing our diverse infrastructure throughout Minnesota. Even with recent bonding appropriations, our deferred maintenance increased by $75 million this year, or about $20 million annually. We estimate we have a backlog of asset preservation needs of $446 million at this time. Another top functional priority area is our request for $2 million for fire operation support infrastructure at the Hibbing Airport. This is a one-time request to address a time-sensitive critical repair that's needed for our housing of our firefighting aircraft at that facility. Our remaining top five categories are betterment of buildings, dam safety, and park accessibility. However, we do want to emphasize that while these are our current priorities, funding in each of our major functional categories is needed to ensure balanced management of the DNR-managed capital assets on which Minnesotans depend for healthy, for health, safety, and natural resource conservation and recreation. Before you today is our fresh off the presses 2019 capital request that outlines some of the things I've just talked about under taking care of what we have. Our first priority, natural resource asset preservation, $71.5 million is in the governor's budget. I talked about the fire operation support infrastructure under protecting public safety at $2 million. We need to replace the aircraft staging area, which are basically access ramps at the air tanker base located in Hibbing, which is, this site is decaying and almost inoperable, threatening both aircraft and pilot safety. Connecting people to the outdoors, our priority is state park and recreation area accessibility, $19.5 million with top priorities at William O'Brien State Park and Fort Snelling State Park. The governor also recommended $2 million in funding for local parks and trail grants to go to local communities throughout the state. And then, Madam Chair, if you just turn to the inside of this handout, you can see it, it defines, highlights our annual need to maintain the DNR assets as 1231 of 18, walking through what that $169 million annual need is between our preventative maintenance, deferred maintenance, renewal and replacement costs within our buildings, assets. The natural resource asset does include all of our trails, infrastructure, wastewater systems. We are fortunate enough to receive the 2017 and 2018 natural resource conservation funding, which included the design of a new wastewater system at Itasca State Park, repairs with a co-located facility in Windham, forest roads and bridges, almost $1.2 million, and so forth. If members are interested, we have an updated report, our 10-year capital asset needs report. We update it on an annual basis, Madam Chair. I have a copy for you, and I have several copies to leave if any members would like to see copies of those.
Yeah.
We'd just like to say thank you for your strong support in the past, and our bonding program, like several others throughout the state, touches every corner of the state, providing local jobs in a quick fashion. We can get money out the door throughout every county within the state on projects that are ready to go, and we appreciate your support.
Mr. Meyer, I have a question. This need at the Hibbing Airport, we just finished the Hibbing Airport in last bonding bill or the bonding bill before that. So if we finished the airport, why do we need more money now?
Madam Chair, this appropriation was not covered under that previous appropriation. So what it is really doing is creating a fortified concrete pad in front of the locations where we're storing our air tankers. This is really thick, high-density concrete. It has to be done to certain levels to ensure the stability of those aircraft and the loading of chemicals and things like that. So it is different than that project, and it's specific to the DNR facilities that we share with that airport at this point in time.
Did you know that you needed that at the time that they were...
Madam Chair,
during the airport?
We had been in discussions with the airport that time. They feel that this is the DNR's responsibility, or the state's responsibility, rather than, because it's just specific to our aircraft fighter or our firefighting needs. It's not specific to any operational needs that the airport was facing at that time.
Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your request, you have $2 million for dam renovation, repair, and removal. Are the Canastillo or Hill Annex pits included in any of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Sancy, no, these are for actual dams that are placed throughout the state that may be owned by the DNR or other state assets or other local units of government that need to be replaced.
Or the beavers?
Madam Chair, no, that would not be covered by that.
Just checking.
Madam Chair and Mr. Mayor, what funding source will cover those safety concerns?
Madam Chair, Representative Sandstedt, I think as you're aware, there had been special bond appropriations for the Canastillo Mine project that provided design kind of components for us to develop a path for that water to go and actually purchase those easements and do some construction. So to cover those projects, we would need a specific bond appropriation related to the Canastillo and Hill Annex mine and your other bill It also has the Aurora or St. James pit as well.
And, Madam Chair, who owns those that actual property right now?
Madam Chair, Representative Sandsteed, the actual pit itself, or it becomes complicated in that these facilities were permitted before the DNR had authority for the permit to mine process that began in the 80s. These facilities were in operation well before that. In the instance of most of them, they were the historical or the non-permitted facilities. The question is, who has the authority? Is it IRB or is it DNR? In our conversations with them, it's been since the state owns the water, supposedly, that it's the DNR's authority. It's kind of a gray area on who would be responsible for the actual management or draining of those pits.
Madam Chair and Mr. Meyer, who owns the wall retaining the water?
Madam Chair, Representative Sandsteed, it depends on what specific part of each pit you're looking at. There are some school trust land assets where Hill Annex Mine is there. I know the railroad had property on the Can of Steel pit on the other end of it. So you'd have to go through and actually see who has the surface ownership around that pit. And, depending on how you would look at it, that would have the surface ownership there.
And, Madam Chair, are you, Mr. Meyer, are you confident that the DNR has no liability in the public safety regarding the Can of Steel and the Hill Annex?
Madam Chair, I believe the state of Minnesota has the responsibility in certain cases.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And does the state of Minnesota mean the DNR?
Madam Chair, I'm referring to the entire state of Minnesota.
They are the state of Minnesota.
Who owns the view?
Madam Chair, everyone.
at the mines and at the parks and on the trail. The thing that most people go to those things for.
Madam Chair, I think that's a question that I can't answer.
No.
Somebody at a higher calling owns most of those things, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Myers, thank you for coming tonight. I'm just curious because you're in there. We had a lot of trail requests this year, and it looks like you're only asking for about $2 million, if I read it right. But maybe it's somewhere else in there, but I couldn't find it. But so I'm just kind of curious how this works with, you know, do you know the history of, you know, I'm speaking a little bit as legacy chair. So what kind of money did you get, you know, in the past pre-legacy, do you know? Or, you know, there's many funds I know, like LCCMR, you get some trail funds. And then and maybe in Chair Hansen's bill, maybe in the environment bill as well. And then legacy and then bonding. So I'm just trying to put my arms around the whole, because it just seems like a kind of a low ask because I know in the metro, I know you don't have as many users. I've kind of heard recently you just, I think you had 10 million users in greater Minnesota. Is that true, Mr. Myers?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Meyer.
Representative Lilly, the usership, yes, you're pretty close on that. This specific appropriation would be for grants, so it's local park and trail grants. It's $2 million that would be used to fund competitive grants to local governments for acquisition and development of local and regional trails and parks across the state. It would not be state-owned assets. So our state-owned assets, the legislature creates a lot of trails, it seems like, in every bonding bill. It's a popular thing to do. However, there's a lack of funding for ongoing maintenance and repair of those trails. It's a discussion that we've had with Chairman Erdahl, Chairman Torkelson, Chairman Murphy, many legislatures ongoing. It's how do we, you know, build it and they will come is great, but then who takes care of it after they leave type of a situation. And some of that is bondable and some of it's not. For example, our crack sealing, things like that are not bondable related expenditures. The governor's initial budget had a $2 million appropriation for us to do that work. When it was gone through after the budget came out, that $2 million was removed in the supplemental budget because there are higher priorities that are out there. So we need to be asking ourselves if we're creating these assets, if we are appropriating state dollars to build a trail, are we going to put our money where our mouth is and take care of those trails once they're created? And some of that can't be done with legacy just because of the restrictions on legacy funding. So as you're putting together a bonding bill now and in the coming years, make sure that we think about and we have a discussion about who takes care of those trails, because it is greatly needed. And they have about a 20-year life cycle, at which time you need to basically grind and redo some subgrade and overlay it again. It's about $100,000 a mile or so. So it's, or more than that, probably by the time we get around to it.
Is on these $2 million, excuse me, I'll get back to you. This $2 million for a grant, are the grants limited to $100,000 or $200,000 or $800,000 or $1 million or $2 million?
Madam Chair, we have a grant program that these dollars go into to fund that, and I can provide you more detailed information on that and past recipients if you'd like to see that as well. Okay,
sure. We'd like information. Representative Lilly?
It's fine.
Representative Lee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And following up, excuse me, on a question that was asked last time to Mr. Lagosmo, if Parker Trail received bonding dollars, can they charge a fee?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't see why they wouldn't be able to. It depends on you could certainly put a rider that would say that they could not charge a fee if they received dollars from that, but there's nothing in law that would prohibit that at this point in time. The zoo receives bonding dollars. They charge an entrance fee. We receive bonding dollars for our state parks. We charge an entrance fee there. So,
but to have some free days.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll leave several copies of this report for
Thank
you.
Thank you. I would like one. Metropolitan Council. They are on our list.
On the chair's list.
No, oh, aren't they on your list?
No.
Oh, my. Oh. How did that happen? It's just like magic coming down from the sky. It is. Yeah, just a scotch. Except so many things were coming up from the Metropolitan Council that are in the Metropolitan Council area that are on our parks and trails and transportation requests on your spreadsheets. I thought, we haven't heard from the Metropolitan Council, and how do I deal with those things? How do you do it? Do you have a list for parks and trails that these are the things that we're doing in this particular order, and we should stop messing around with your grand plan?
Madam Chair, my name is Brooke Bortz, and I'm in the Government Affairs Department at the Metropolitan Council. Yes. With me is Lisa Barajas from our Community Development Department, and she would be able to answer that question very specifically.
Good. Ms. Barajas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have 10 implementing agencies in the metropolitan area, so counties, cities, and special parks districts that actually, I believe, have put in those requests that are on your list in front of you today. The council is the fiscal agent for dollars coming from the metropolitan or coming from the state to the metro area for parks and trails. You should know that the implementing agencies all develop master plans for each of the regional parks and trails in the metro area and identify all of the capital investments that they're going to make as part of that. So I believe off the top of my head that all of the items on that list are part of master plans that the council has reviewed and approved that local implementing agencies have developed.
Oh, so you have a master plan, and you have a group of things that you want done. So you go find somebody to carry those bills that has your master plan in it?
Madam,
and they come in little pieces before us, and that's why there's so many?
Madam Chair, committee members, the council does a broader regional plan, and our requests from the Metropolitan Council come through the governor's budget, and this year we did not have additional bonding requests for regional parks. That being said, our implementing agencies do make requests on their own, and that's what you're seeing before you, I believe.
What do you mean by implementing agency?
Madam Chair, within the metro area, the Metropolitan Council does not own or operate any of the regional park system. There are 10 agencies that do that. So that includes the Minneapolis Park and Rec Board, the City of St. Paul, the City of Bloomington, Anoka County, Dakota County, Scott County, Carver County, Washington County, and Three Rivers Park District. They may have left out somebody, but those are the agencies designated in law as the implementing agencies of the regional park system in the metro area.
I think I understand better. Mm-hmm. So if we put something in that's on the list, that's not on the governor's list, then are there enough people in the within the Metropolitan Council or within the 10 agencies to implement the project that we include that wasn't on the plan before?
Madam Chair, committee members, my assumption is that implementing agencies are proposing projects that they can complete. I couldn't speak to their capacity to do so otherwise. At the council, as a fiscal agent, we do have finance and grant administration staff that this is their job. That is what we do, is manage the funds for the region, for regional parks and trails. So whether you add projects or not is just the part of the work that we do on an annual basis.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to, in that House File 80 that Chair Murphy, you carried, there was a $10 million.
The governor signed.
Congratulations. There was a $10 million tweak in there for the Metro Parks agencies, and those 10 agencies had an agreement on where those would go. And one thing that's really neat about this, too, is I think the Met Council, maybe you can get out of the testifiers, matches some of the money, so it has a compounding kind of effect. But there's 58,000 people that are using these trails in the metro, so it's very popular for, you know, those sort of things. But if you care to add that to your sheet, which is due tomorrow, it's House File 2163 and line 198. Just saying.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So given any of the parks that or systems that fall through all of these slots and everything like that, and they come then to your purview, and then you hand it out to an implementing agency, and they know and have budgeted and or resources to be able to maintain that resource into the future? That was a rhetorical question, but I hope there's an answer.
Ms. Barra Haas.
Madam Chair, committee members, there certainly as part of the master planning process, and implementing agencies do plan for the operation and maintenance of the system over time. That's also part of a state allocation that we get on every biennium, I believe, as well. And so there's an operations and maintenance funding that comes from the state as well, but that has amounted to about 8% or 9% of the total O&M funds to manage the regional system, where the local units of government, the implementing agencies, are picking up the remaining cost.
Represent some.
Just a quick, then I'm just going to take you one step because you just gave me something and now I want to find out. So which one of us here at the state, because I suspect that's what you're inferring, which one of us is the source of that funding that eventually goes to maintenance?
Madam Chair, committee members.
You've been impressing me with this access of where you look for something and you find it. So,
to my recollection, operation and maintenance funding is also in the governor's budget, and we had presented it earlier this year to the Environment Finance Committee. It was in January, so it's a little foggy in my brain. But that's that would come from the governor's budget as well.
Thank you.
that certainly clarifies things a little bit better. Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair, I just want to apologize. I said 58,000 users. It's 58 million.
58 million?
A little different.
They must go more than once. And they get counted every time they go?
Possibly. So each time you do the tunnel, like.
Because we don't have 58 million. You know, that's a lot more than we have.
Madam Chair, they could be coming from other states as well.
Have to have a wall. Night, page 12, line 183, BC. Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Renke, Benke, MPCA.
How many are there?
They keep popping up. Huh?
Madam Chair?
They realize this is their last chance.
How many more we got?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Benke. I'm the Director of the Resource Management Assistance Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. One of the duties that we have there is to deal with solid waste or trash. And so, you know, for me, a discussion for a day that doesn't have trash in it is like a day without sunshine, so I thought I'd share a little sunshine with you this evening. So we can we've got four projects for you in the request from the MPCA. They all deal with managing waste as an integrated waste management system. The first is to manage organic material. Currently in the waste stream, that makes up about 30% of what's left, and it's the largest single segment that's left to manage. And we want to get that out of the waste stream. This would be the grants to local units of government across the state to enhance our organics collection system by getting that out of the waste stream. We envision the grants would go for compost pads to deal with managing the organics to create compost, transfer stations, equipment, and other infrastructure for that. In addition to that project, we have three local projects on the list, and one is for Clay County for their resource recovery campus up in Clay County. They are looking to enhance their transfer station, their household hazardous waste management facility, and their problem materials collection. Clay County is part of the Prairie Lake Solid Waste Management Authority, which includes five counties up in that area, and they manage their waste at the resource recovery facility in Perham. This would allow them to manage the waste prior to transportation down to Perham more effectively, keeping bulky items, the problem materials, and the household hazardous waste out of the waste stream before it's sent down there. In addition to that, we have a project from Coon Rapids in Anoka County to develop their recycling center further. Coon Rapids right now takes a lot of the materials that won't be collected for recycling on the curb by the waste haulers, including styrofoam, some of the plastics, and other materials that aren't currently recycled for the household. This allows the community a place to take those materials and drop them off for recycling rather than have them end up in the landfill. Last facility we have is from Hennepin County to take their Brooklyn Park Transfer Station and develop that further for organics diversion. They currently are accepting waste there, but the space isn't conducive for them to manage the organics properly, similar to the grants that we talked about initially. So with that, can answer any questions that you might have about the projects from the PCA.
How much is that?
Total is $16,500,000.
Thank you. Anyone else?
You sure?
If not, this meeting is adjourned.